Today on Against the Grain, the pandemic highlighted the vital importance of care work, whether childcare, nursing home care, medical care, or schooling, and the struggles many people face to get sufficient care. Would more public investment solve the crisis? Historian Premila Nadasen argues that the problem lies with contemporary capitalism itself, as care has become an enormous arena for corporate profit. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In recent years, liberal feminism has focused on the politics of care, highlighting the struggles many middle-class workers face over getting adequate care and balancing the demands of jobs and unpaid care work. But as Premila Nadasen argues in her book, Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism, which is published by Haymarket Books, what's missing from much of the discourse is the centrality of privatized care in our economy and its highly exploited workers. Nadasen is professor of history at Barnard College and is co-director of the Center for Research on Women there. Premila, can you define the care economy and tell us how significant is it within the larger U.S. economy?
When I talk about the care economy, I'm talking about the way that profit is extracted from our need to care for ourselves, for our families, and for our communities. So it really is about profit extraction. And we see profit happening on multiple levels from the private sector, of course. This is in the healthcare industry, the childcare industry, the welfare system, the carceral state, people's basic ability to live, to feed themselves, to house themselves is in fact a source of profit. And I think what is significant for me is how this has expanded and grown over the past 50 years or so. Care has always been a site of profit, but what we are seeing now is that it's become a much more crucial part of the economy, and I would say a cornerstone of the economy. So if we just look, for example, at statistics of employment, from 1980 to 2020, the percentage of workers who were in manufacturing fell from 22% to 8%. During that same period, the percentage of people employed in healthcare and education alone, and those are two core sectors of what I call the care economy, doubled from 8% to 15%. And that doesn't include private household workers or food service workers. Of the top 10 Fortune 500 companies today, and that's defined by revenue, four are part of the care economy: CVS Health, United Health Group, McKesson, which is a pharmaceutical company, and AmerisourceBergen, which is a wholesale drug company. By contrast, in 1980, the top 10 included six oil and gas companies, two tech firms, and two auto manufacturers. So care is much more important when we think about how the economy works overall and the amount of dollars that households spend on care, including healthcare, education, food, and housing.
So to what do you attribute that shift? I mean, on the one hand, one could point to deindustrialization, right? But why that explosive growth of this part of the economy?
I think part of it had to do with deindustrialization, as you say, because there are fewer jobs in manufacturing, there are fewer jobs in production in places like the United States. Production and manufacturing are still important overall to our economy. Globally, a lot of our manufactured products are imported. So the question is, how are Americans working? Where are Americans working? And the answer to that is in the service sector. And when we think about the service sector, we're talking about the services and the support that we all need in order to live, in order to survive, in order to feed ourselves, in order to care for the sick and the disabled and the elderly and the children. And some of it had to do with shifts in public spending and welfare spending. And some of this can be attributed to the dismantling of the welfare system. So in 1996, the core welfare program, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, was dismantled and turned into block grants to states. States are now able to use that money in a variety of ways. Previously, there were restraints on how that money could be spent. If someone fell below a certain income threshold and they met the criteria of the program, they were entitled to a basic minimum standard, basic minimum income. That is no longer the case. So states get welfare money. They can use that money on outsourcing some of their administrative work, on hiring a company to fingerprint applicants, on hiring companies to train welfare recipients. Whether or not they get a job is irrelevant. So welfare money is used in a number of different ways. A lot of public programs today are outsourced to private companies. Just one example I could give you is a company called Maximus, which is one of the largest health and human services contractors with local, state, and federal governments. And they run things like child support enforcement, the Affordable Care Act, welfare to work programs, among other things. In the winter of 2022, Maximus had $3.7 billion worth of state contracts in New York alone. The growth strategy for Maximus, as outlined in its 10K filing to the SEC, is, in their words, the increasing demographic of people who are, quote, experiencing financial hardships and other barriers. And so, in other words, Maximus profits from poverty. And I think this is what is most troubling to me about the care economy, is that the companies that are stepping in, that are profiting from poverty, are actually making a lot of money, but in fact, they are not addressing the real sources of poverty. There's been growing inequality in this country. 40 million Americans are impoverished today. And so there is a fundamental contradiction between a company that wants to make money off of poverty and our, I think, collective social desire to alleviate the problem of poverty.
Sure. Well, let me ask you about the nonprofit sector, because when you ask the question, who benefits from the care economy, the answer is different sectors, but not the poor. So tell us about the role of the nonprofit sector in benefiting from this expanded care economy.
The nonprofit sector has expanded enormously over the past 40 years alongside the care economy. And like for-profit industries that see an interest in growing poverty and the care crisis, the nonprofit sector thrives in a context where there is need, right? They are created, nonprofits are created to address a social problem, a social dilemma. And I think they grow to such an extent that, in fact, their very existence necessitates this ongoing social problem. So I'll just give you one example that that I mentioned in the book, and that is the group Feeding America, which rescues food from restaurants, from supermarkets, and transports that food to food pantries. And I met many years ago, I met a very interesting woman named Teresa Funicello, who wrote a book called The Tyranny of Kindness. She was a welfare recipient who went on to work for the New York State government and began to witness the way the question of hunger was addressed, and how the emphasis and the focus was on finding ways to transfer this food that had been discarded to people who were hungry. And she did this amazing analysis that looked at the cost of, for example, transporting something like a head of lettuce from a supermarket to a food pantry and the cost that was associated with that, both the people cost as well as the travel costs. And you know, what she concluded is it's not a very efficient system. In fact, if we took all that money that was invested in moving discarded food from one location to another location and trying to figure out a system of getting it to where it's supposed to be, if in fact we took that money and we just gave it to poor people, they would be much better off. The problem, as she argues, is not a shortage of food in this country. It's a question of resources and a question of distribution, that in fact all we need to do is give poor people money and they would be able to buy the food and the other basic items that they needed.
Staying with the question you just raised about the efficiency of the system that we have, we often hear about a care crisis. How we define that care crisis is itself subject to debate. How do you think the system that we have of care, this care economy, serves poor people, and how does it serve middle class people?
I think we have a real inequity in how care is distributed in this country. A two-tier system, maybe even a multi-tiered system. We live in a country where some people are cared for and some people are not cared for. The very well-off have access to a lot of services and support, and they have the means to be able to purchase those services and support. They are also part of the care economy because those companies are making money off of them. The middle class, it's not easy for them, but they do have some support. Middle class people and families do have some resources to purchase some care needs in the market. The working class has a very hard time, but they might benefit from certain programs, certain federal programs in particular, or state programs, tax credits if they're working. They would benefit from those sorts of programs, but the very poorest have nothing. Since the dismantling of entitlement programs, we don't have anything like a guaranteed annual income. We don't have anything like a welfare system that actually does support people. It means that the people who are outside the labor market, the people who would the greatest need, have actually no resources and no support to take care of themselves and their families. And this multi-tiered system exists because care is privatized. And by care, I don't only mean child care. I mean our access to housing, our access to food, our access to health care. All of that is part and parcel of the care economy. Marxist feminists use a term called social reproduction. And I think in some ways that's a better way to think about it. Social reproduction, as they understand it, is all the labor and the resources necessary to sustain the current generation of workers and to reproduce the next generation of workers. And so those basic needs are not something that we as a country have decided at this moment that we're going to support. Private sector workers who are well off have, for example, Google workers, have very generous benefits. They have on-site child care. They have something called child bonding bucks, where the company helps with the costs of a newborn baby, paying for things like diapers and a formula. They have 18 weeks of paid leave. These are very privileged benefits that the vast majority of people in this country do not have access to.
Pramila Nadesan is my guest. We're discussing your book, Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I wonder if you could turn to the roots of the care economy in the United States. How should we understand its origins?
Care has always been a site of profit for certain categories of people. And we can see this most clearly during the era of slavery, when enslaved people took care of themselves and took care of their families and raised their children. But everything they did in their homes was for the benefit of the plantation owner and the slave owner. And that's a very vivid example of how one's basic desire to care for oneself is a site of profit and extraction. Over the course of the 20th century, we see the expansion of the welfare state, but care has always been a site of profit. We've never lived in a country, the United States has never been a country where people have been fully supported in their basic needs. Nearly everything has been extracted from the private sector and from the market economy. And so there's a very long history of profit extraction. This was, I think, in a lot of ways, secondary to manufacturing for the vast majority of capitalists throughout the 20th century. Most of the profit came from manufacturing, and care was understood as perhaps necessary in order to support the manufacturing sector. So we needed to provide housing. The New Deal was designed to provide certain kinds of supports to people. The Social Security system, unemployment benefits, all of these are what we might call some of the ways that the government has extended care to ordinary families. The New Deal was designed to bolster and to prop up the manufacturing sector. With the decline of manufacturing in the 1970s and 60s and the 1970s, there is a shift away from manufacturing as a crux of the U.S. economy towards a greater reliance and emphasis on the service sector, a large portion of which is the care economy. And so I think there's a long tendency for this, although the character of it and the scope of it has expanded enormously over the past 40 to 50 years.
Well, in thinking about the trajectory of the care economy and that shift that you just mentioned over the last 40 to 50 years, what is often termed neoliberalism and often characterized by critics as the withdrawal of the state from the economy, although this is very much a contested question, you argue that the state has actually been crucial in abetting the growth of the for-profit care economy. How do you understand the role of the state over the last 40 or so years during this period of neoliberalism?
I think the state has retreated in terms of its responsibility, and the state has retreated in terms of ensuring entitlements, ensuring that people are cared for. But the state is still spending a tremendous amount of money on care for Americans, if we want to think about it that way. So during the pandemic alone, the federal government spent nearly $5 trillion. That is a massive amount of money. The majority of that money did not go to individual households and families. The majority of that money went to businesses, hospitals, schools, state and local governments. Some of that money went to, I'll just give you one example here, went to a company called Regeneron. And Regeneron got $450 million from the federal government to develop an antibody treatment for COVID. Regeneron used federal money to develop that treatment, but it holds the patent. Americans did get the first series of doses paid for by the federal government. But once that initial the initial vaccines were done, the federal government had to buy additional doses from Regeneron. Regeneron charges 10 times what it costs to manufacture the treatment. Cigna, during the pandemic, earned a profit of $5.5 billion. United Healthcare, $17 billion. So I think what we have seen is how federal money, state money, local money is actually going to line the pockets of private corporations or politicians. There's one really egregious case in Mississippi where the head of the Department of Human Services John Davis, used the state's welfare money to enrich himself and his friends. And they purchased fancy vehicles, they went on vacation, they covered the cost of the mortgage on a ranch of a football star. Millions of dollars in speaking fees were paid to friends. It was about $77 million, which is nearly equal to a year's worth of the state's welfare funds. And he did this by signing a contract with a nonprofit that was run by his friends and supporters. So he had a tremendous amount of influence on how that money was spent. Now, John Davis and the example in Mississippi, I think, is an example of fraud. He was brought up on charges and pled guilty. But it's indicative of the way there is actually very few guardrails and very few restraints on how federal or state money or public money is spent. And there's a lot of people making money off of the public sector. So I think as we, you know, there's been a lot of calls over the past couple of years for expanded investment in care. And we see that as somehow a better alternative to other kinds of federal spending. And I think it can be, but I don't think we can assume it is. And I think we have to look very carefully at how public dollars are spent, who has control over those public dollars, who's making the decisions, and who's benefiting. Because that money is not always going to the people who we think it's going to. And if we set it aside to alleviate poverty, if we set it aside for childcare, if we set it aside for healthcare, as a way to address these problems that American families of all class backgrounds are facing, then I think we have to ensure that it is meant in a way that we intend it to.
And we'll return precisely to some of those debates in a moment. But I wanted to ask you, also staying with the thread of this expanded care economy, what role do you see coercion playing as an element of care work as it's constituted within this care economy?
Care work is a fairly broad category. So it includes people who are healthcare workers, teachers, restaurant workers, as well as what we normally think of as care workers, which are private household workers. So there's people of various economic backgrounds who are involved in the care economy and who labor as care workers. One of the things that I want us to think about actually is who we call a care worker and why some people are called care workers but not other people. We tend to think about care work as labor that involves some kind of nurturing or an emotional investment. But in fact, many of the people who are put into that category of care worker is not actually doing nurturing work. And we can think about domestic workers who are cleaning. They might not interact with another human being. Someone who works in a hospital in the laundry room. They're actually not interacting with patients, but they're part of the hospital and healthcare industry. And so there's a lot of jobs in these industries, whether it's domestic work or healthcare, who are not actually doing nurturing emotional work. Whereas there are other people who we don't put into that category of care work, who I think are doing nurturing work or might be emotionally invested. Athletic coaches, for example. Or doormen in buildings, or financial advisors. We would presume that they have some emotional connection, that they are invested in the people who they're taking care of. So I think we have to disentangle that language of care work from the actual labor that takes place. But I think for the way most people think about care workers, meaning domestic workers, coercion has played a central role in it. This workforce has tended to be people who have very few other economic options for whatever reason. During the early part of the 20th century, African American women were confined to domestic work, even if they were educated, because of Jim Crow segregation and because other jobs were simply not available to them, regardless of their skill or experience. More recently, we find the occupation of domestic work dominated by a lot of immigrants who, again, might not have opportunities for other kinds of jobs because of their legal status or because they don't have the credentials to practice whatever their profession is in the United States. And so because people don't have other options, because domestic work is the kind of work that is isolated, meaning that people are working in private homes, because there is a real power imbalance between employer and employee, coercion does play a huge role in shaping what the labor looks like, what kinds of rights people have, their confidence or their ability to be able to speak out and challenge mistreatment or underpayment. So coercion is really central to household labor, to domestic work, and is increasingly important, I think, in the broader care work industry as well. Many of the nurses who are now working in hospitals are actually contract workers, might be from the Philippines or from some other part of the world. And they are here on short-term contracts, maybe for 3 years or for 5 years. But those contracts have a lot of stipulations about switching to another employer, about their ability to even talk about things like their salary. They often come here indebted to a recruitment company, so they have to pay that company back before they can even leave the job that they're in now. And so the labor contract has also served as a kind of tool to enforce certain kinds of labor standards and has been a mechanism of coercion.
We've been talking a fair amount about the care economy and care work from the top down, but you've just been describing the conditions that workers face. And I wanted to ask you, because this is something that you look at in your book, about the resistance of care workers, even though they may face coercion and isolation that may make resistance particularly tricky.
There's a very long history of organizing and resistance among care workers, domestic workers, precarious service sector workers. In the 1960s and the 1970s, there was a fairly large nationwide movement of domestic workers led by African American women, although they were, it was a multiracial movement. And they fought for rights and protections. Domestic work was one of the few categories that was excluded from the New Deal. That is, when the vast majority of workers in this country got things like minimum wage protection, Social Security benefits, and unemployment, domestic workers and agricultural workers were excluded from those provisions. In the 1960s and 70s, domestic workers mobilized in order to fight for and demand access to those labor rights, and they were successful. So by 1974, they won, for the first time, federal minimum wage protections. They did have, there were some states that had given them those protections previously, but in 1974, they were successful in changing federal law to ensure that they had minimum wage protections. But more recently, we have seen a major upsurge of labor organizing led primarily by service sector workers, who many of whom are part of this care industry, who are organizing as union members and outside of unions. So teachers, for example, have been at the forefront since 2018, have organized throughout the South, in Chicago, in Seattle, and in Portland. And they are organizing not just as workers, but they're also organizing on behalf of their students. So they understand their struggle as tied to the well-being of the community more broadly. There have been home health care aides restaurant workers who have organized as a part of the Fight for 15 movement. And that is the movement that a few years ago was pushing for a basic minimum wage of $15 an hour. And then domestic workers, of course, have been really critical even in the recent past. There was another movement that emerged around 2000 of domestic workers started in New York City with the formation of the Domestic Workers United organization, but became a national movement in 2007 with the formation of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. There was also an international organization that was formed that managed to pass a convention, an International Labor Organization convention on domestic work. And so this organizing of all of these sectors, domestic workers, restaurant workers, taxi drivers, home health care aides, teachers, I think are the forefront of what the labor movement looks like today. It is not the manufacturing workers. We've seen important victories, I have to say, at the UAW recently, and that's very heartening. But I think we also have to think about the ways in which service sector workers are really redefining the meaning of labor and labor rights.
Pramila Nadesan is my guest. We're discussing her book, Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism, which is published by Haymarket Books. She's professor of history at Barnard College, where she co-directs the Barnard Center for Research on Women. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So as you alluded to earlier, in recent years, and especially during the pandemic, liberal feminists and progressives have turned their focus on care, often supporting a notion of a renewed welfare state after decades of neoliberal cuts to the social safety net. Can you tell us why, and you started to touch on this, but why you are cautious about this approach, that a focus on expanded care work as an alternative to the prevailing neoliberal system may be problematic or insufficient?
So I think two things are important here. One is the way care is talked about, especially in the mainstream press today, largely coming out of the pandemic. It is understood as a kind of a universal politics. There's a sense of mutual dependency. We all need care. We're all invested in care. We're all in this together. We take care of one another. And I think that language really masks the inequity in care that I talked about earlier. This privatized system where some people are taken care of and some people are not. And some people are taking care of other people and are not taken care of. And so I think there's real inequity in care. So even though there is this universal discourse, it does not apply universally to everyone. The fact is, some people's care is privileged over other people's care. So during the pandemic, there was this kind of visible recognition of essential workers and care workers, and the recognition of these workers and thanking them and valuing them was a really prominent discourse. But these workers didn't always get the pay and the benefits and the protections that they needed and deserved. I work with a Filipino organization here in New York City called the Damayan Migrant Workers Association, most of whom are domestic workers and private household workers. And I heard horrific stories about them being fired, about part-time workers who were expected to work full-time without additional payment, about people who were expected to live in or else lose their jobs. So there was a real disconnect between what people were saying about domestic workers and essential workers and the way these workers were actually treated. And I think the second thing, I guess associated with this, is that the value attached to care workers is often framed in terms of the service they provide. That is, people were considered important to the degree that they took care of other more privileged people. So the framing was, we need to value these workers because they care for us. But I think that people should be valued regardless. Their rights as human beings, their need to be taken care of, to have the resources to care for their own families, is not dependent on a service they provide. It's dependent on the fact that they are human beings who are living close to us, who are in need. And so I think that question of the discourse of care is one of the problems I have. The other issue is, I think, the care discourse and the calls for greater investment in care and thinking about care politics as an alternative to neoliberalism hasn't adequately grappled with the question of profit extraction in care. And very few people have talked about the ways in which public money and certainly private money is going towards fueling the inequality. So I think the expectation and, you know, much of the advocacy and the organizing around an expanded care infrastructure comes from a very good place. It comes from people who want to alleviate the problem of poverty, who want to ensure that we address the child care crisis, who want to ensure that people are taken care of. But I think if we aren't mindful of how that money is spent and who has control over it, I think what we're going to end up seeing is, in fact, an exacerbation of the very thing that we're trying to alleviate.
Well, let me ask you more about that and moving kind of further to the left here. Earlier, you spoke of the concept of social reproduction, an idea that comes out of Marxist feminism about the central importance of the work of caring for workers and raising the next generation of workers. Often this work has been unpaid, and the argument goes that it's absolutely fundamentally necessary for capitalism. One of the arguments that Marxist feminists make is that because social reproduction is so necessary for capital accumulation, if care work, the work of reproducing the working class, is in crisis, which everyone argues it is at this point, that the fabric of care is falling apart, that that would have an impact on capital accumulation, which is the heart of the capitalist system. But you argue that you don't think that it's a question of social reproduction versus capital accumulation. Can you explain why you think that capital accumulation is not being diminished by this crisis of social reproduction?
Sure. So Marxist feminists come, and it's a, you know, the category Marxist feminist is fairly broad, and, you know, and there's lots of tendencies within it. So I'm gonna simplify a little bit. But Marxist feminists tend to believe that there is a fundamental tension between social reproduction and capital accumulation. So that is that when employers give workers more money, right, that additional money goes towards supporting the family and the household, right? But the higher wage takes away from capitalist profit. When governments tax corporations in order to create a welfare state, that additional money is going towards workers or families to support them in their day-to-day lives, but that money is cutting into capitalist profit because of the tax. And so they historically see a tension between social reproduction and capital accumulation, assuming that capital relies on the labor of social reproduction to reproduce its labor force. Women in the household, unpaid labor, domestic workers, everything I'm calling the care economy is necessary because it reproduces the labor force. Capital needs this labor force, but it doesn't actually want to support the labor force. So its tendency is to reduce the investment in the reproduction of that labor force. And so that's the basic argument of Marxist feminists, who then argue that if, in fact, capital reduces the support for social reproduction to such a degree that there is a crisis of care, there will no longer be the reproduction of the labor force, and capital itself will find itself in crisis. I think what I've seen in my work is that, yes, we are indeed in a crisis of care, and I do not dispute that. I think we're in a serious crisis of care. But because the basic contours of the American economy has shifted in that manufacturing is a much smaller part of the economy, we are less reliant on the reproduction of a traditional labor force for commodity production. And capital is now finding new sources of accumulation and wealth in the very crisis of social reproduction. So when families are unable to afford childcare, and when the government is not providing childcare, it is creating a crisis. But then people are finding, or have to find, ways in the marketplace to meet that need. And that might mean paying $40,000 for childcare for a three-year-old, right? It might mean, calling backup babysitters. But if we're in fact in crisis, we have to find a way to address that crisis. The federal government might step in and provide some money for that, but that money is, because we live in a privatized system, that money is essentially going back into the private sector and is part and parcel of the process of capital accumulation. So what I've seen is that the crisis has become a source of profit for companies. And we have seen this as well with companies that are increasingly investing in care. So there was a company that was founded by Melissa French Gates called Pivotal Ventures that has produced both an investor's guide and an entrepreneur's guide to the care economy. Private equity is increasingly investing in things like childcare, in affordable housing. So many companies, many investment firms are understanding that care is a new frontier in capital accumulation precisely because of the crisis that people are finding themselves in right now.
Just following that up, could there be a point where the offset of profiting from the care economy is not sufficient to stench whatever is leaking out of the economy otherwise? Or do you think this is a kind of spiral that can just sort of continue downwards because new frontiers are always going to be discovered?
I'm not sure. I mean, I can't predict the future. So all I'm talking about is what I see right now. I don't know if this is sustainable. The Boston Consulting Group estimates that the worth of the care economy is $6 trillion, and they include in that estimate both paid labor and unpaid labor. That's an enormous amount of money. So I don't know if it's sustainable, and I don't know if it means that capitalism will collapse. I don't know if it means that they will find other sources of accumulation out of this. I don't know what this kind of profiting from the care economy will mean for the people who are at the very bottom, who don't have the resources. But I do think that this is a problem we should be seriously concerned about at this moment for anyone who cares about a truly just society, for anybody who is invested in thinking about how to create a more caring world. I think this really needs to be at the forefront of our agenda.
Historian Pramila Nadasen is my guest. We're discussing care, the highest stage of capitalism. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, then, in terms of how we might think of care for those who would like to get beyond not just neoliberalism, but capitalism itself, you've been arguing that trying to pull the state back in to fund more care work is problematic. I wonder if you could talk about other alternatives to the system that we live under in terms of care, ones that you say have deep roots in this country.
So I think this question about kind of how do we move forward is a moral and an ethical question. It cannot be a question of the economy. I would assert that no one should make money off of someone else's disability, pain, disease, crisis, hunger, or housing insecurity. And that is, in fact, the system we have now. And so I think we need to get to a place where we understand that as a kind of basic starting point for how we want to move forward. Our goal should be to abolish the profit-oriented care economy and to create a society where everyone has their basic needs met: housing, food, healthcare, education. In terms of how to get there, I think that I haven't given up on all forms of state investment or state involvement. I think the state can be a site of struggle and a site of possible solutions, but I don't think as the state programs that are currently in existence and the proposals that I have seen that have come forth in the past few years are not the solution to the care crisis. And I think fuel rather than dismantle the care economy. I think first and foremost, we just have to understand how the current system works. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book. Because I think there are people who really are trying to do good, but they may not fully understand the outcomes or the implications of their actions. But I think there are also a lot of people who are benefiting from this current system, and those are people who don't want change. And that's what we should be talking about, those particular people who are benefiting from this system. I was just going to talk about some of the examples I saw during the pandemic, examples of collective care and communal care, ways in which people, in the absence of any real systemic support or government support, people who just stepped up to take care of one another. There were mutual aid organizations. There were, in my neighborhood, there was a friendly fridge where our upstairs neighbor restocked that fridge for anybody who needed food. So there was an amazing capacity of people to care for one another, of people helping other people. Activist organizations gave out care packages. And this is one model to think about how people imagine care in their own day-to-day lives. We all take care of other people around us. And I think those are the kind of resources and the initiatives that we really need to build upon.
Given the argument that you've been making that a lot of the discourse on care leaves out the problematic side of care, do you think that some of the debates and discussion around care now are colored by that, or would you argue that we should still think of care as central to any sort of society that we would want to live in?
I think care absolutely should be central to how we structure any kind of society. I think care is the central preoccupation for most of us on a day-to-day basis. We think about what we might go home and eat. We might think about what to make for dinner. We might think about where our kids are going to be later. We think about spending time with people for the holidays. That is the central concern for nearly everyone when they think about their day-to-day lives. People work in order to have that time with the people they love. So I think care is how we understand our lives, is the center of our lives, and should be the center of our lives. And we should, in fact, have a society that is structured in order to support that and in order to allow us to fully realize that. My concern is not about valuing care or not valuing care. It is about this current moment of capitalism, where I see care as a site of extraction and profit. So the very things that we care most deeply about, our elderly parents who are in a nursing home, or our children who we leave to go to work every day, that our love for them is becoming a way for other people to extract money from us, often at the expense of their well-being. We know stories about children who are not well taken care of, or people in nursing homes who are not well taken care of. And the reason for that is because the goal there is not to care for them if it is in privatized care, but it is to make money. And I think there is a real tension there between that question of care and profit. And so I think all of those basic needs that we have need to be taken out of a profit-oriented economy.
Premila Nadasen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Sasha. It was lovely speaking with you.
Premila Nadasen is the author of CARE, The Highest Stage of Capitalism. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. That book is published by Haymarket. Her other books include Welfare Warriors, the Welfare Rights Movement in the United States, and Household Workers Unite, the Untold Story of African-American Women Who Built a Movement. Premila Nadasen is professor of history at Barnard College, where she co-directs the Barnard Center for Research on Women. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.